Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. That war has taken a new turn in the past days with the revelation that back in August, the Chinese Communist Party successfully tested the capability to launch into orbit a hypersonic vehicle that is believed to be capable of carrying a nuclear weapon any place on Earth in very short order and in ways that can both minimize the chance of detection and any possible intercept. In other words, the perfect sneak attack weapon. And it is now apparently entering the Chinese arsenal, a potentially mortal threat to the United States. A man who has been reflecting on this particular development and what's going on in space, both at the hands of the Chinese and others more generally, is our first guest. His name is Michael Listner. He is an attorney by training, but he runs a terrific outfit, the Space Law and Policy Solutions think tank up in New Hampshire. You can follow his work at spacelawsolutions.com, where I recently came across a very insightful report about what the Chinese have just done and its implications. He publishes a for subscription newsletter, a briefing letter, he calls it, entitled The Precis, P-R-E-C-I-S. You can find out more about it there at spacelawsolutions.com. I'm delighted to have Michael Listner with us for the first time. Thank you for the work you do, Michael, and for sharing it with us today.
Well, thank you for having me this morning, Frank.
I'm really pleased to do so because I have been in this business for a long time and remember, not that I was on duty then, but do remember the fractional orbital ballistic system that the Soviet Union fielded for a time. This was of great concern for similar reasons. Give us a little bit of that background, if you would. What did the Soviets do? How did the United States respond to it? And what are the implications if the Chinese have now not only replicated that capability, but perhaps greatly enhanced it with this hypersonic technology?
Well, the idea behind fractional orbital bombardment system, or FOBS, we call it FOBS for short, is it basically puts a new twist on delivering a nuclear weapon or a nuclear payload to a rival country. ICBMs basically, when they launch a nuclear weapon, they launch it in what we call a ballistic curve, where it maybe just stays in space for a little bit and then comes down on a ballistic trajectory. What the fractional orbital bombardment system does, it launches a warhead almost in the same way that it would launch, say, a spacecraft or a satellite. It launches it actually into an orbit. Now, the difference between fractional orbital bombardment and an actual satellite is once the warhead is in that orbit, it doesn't stay there for a complete orbit. But what it does, when it gets over to the point where it's going over a territory or its target, it fires an engine to break itself out of orbit and then falls down onto its target. Now, the idea behind this is, you know, conventional ICBM RVs, you have an RV track that's actually predictable. Now, the old Soviet system basically used a warhead that probably had limited maneuvering capability. However, what the Chinese have done is they've actually married the idea of fractional orbital bombardment with a maneuverable hypersonic vehicle. So back during the Johnson era administration, when this FOBS system was being tested and actually deployed by the Soviets, there was a lot of consternation about it, you know, because the idea was, you know, we wouldn't be able to detect it. This could actually incite what we call nuclear pinning of our forces on land, in particular ICBM fields and bomber bases. It could have been used for what we call preemption But and there was a lot of concern about it. But the big thing that came up was, you know what, is this legal? Now, a few months before this, for the Soviets tested the system, before the system was actually detected and you know, analyzed, we entered into this agreement called the Outer Space Treaty. And that, that happened in January of 1967. And one of the things in this Outer Space Treaty is said that, you know, you cannot orbit or place nuclear weapons in orbit. So the big question was, did this violate the Outer Space Treaty? And then really, and looking at some of the documents from the Johnson administration era, there was really a big argument about this among some of the agencies like Department of Defense, NASA, even the State Department, saying, oh my, no, this is actually a violation. They violated the Outer Space Treaty right out of the gate. I mean, just months before after signing this treaty with the U.S. So the Johnson administration stepped back and looked at it, and Robert McNamara in particular stepped up and said, no, it doesn't violate the Outer Space. It doesn't violate this provision of the Outer Space Treaty, which caused a lot of consternation from the other departments, DOD, NASA, State Department. But ultimately, the Johnson administration took the position that no, it doesn't violate the Outer Space Treaty. That was the position, the policy position that they took. So I find it very interesting now that I'm seeing some, you know, I'm seeing some comments from people blurting out, well, this weapon divide, you know, developed by the Chinese and tested by the Chinese. Oh my God, this is fractional orbital bombardment system. This is illegal under the Outer Space Treaty because of Article 4. And my response is, well, wait a minute, you know, let's step back and take a look at it. This because really it. The question is, it may not be illegal. In fact, might be consistent with U.S. policy going back to the Johnson administration.
So we don't have the fig leaf of international law to protect us against this threat. Do we have anything else in the inventory at the moment that can contend with the possibility that we would not only have this very fast flying and maneuvering vehicle delivering a nuclear payload to targets inside the United States, and maybe they're bomber bases, maybe they're command and control facilities, maybe they're ICBM fields, more likely they're submarine bases, it's some combination of those things, or maybe it's just an electromagnetic pulse lay down, which would be catastrophic for the country, not just our military, but the country as well. Is there something that can protect us on hand at the moment in the event that this kind of strike is launched by the Chinese Communist Party?
Well, there's nothing that's publicly in the know, and anything like that would probably be classified in some, you know, some special access program that, you know, you really have to have a lot of clearance and a lot of people saying, okay, you can look at it and see what it is. So there's nothing that's publicly, no capability that's publicly known that would be able to defeat this. Now, going back to the Johnson era, and you know they're basically coming out and saying, well, we have no legal recourse. On the other hand, what we're going to do is we're going to install a countermeasure. And what they did was they basically developed and deployed the world's first operational anti-satellite weapon, and that was called Program 437. Now, what Program 437 did was it based Thor missiles with nuclear warheads on Johnston Island, and the idea was when these fractional orbital bombardment systems were launched, they would, you know, we would get the satellite, the Thor missiles would launch, the nuclear warheads would come within close proximity, detonate, and the EMP and the neutron flux would basically fry out the guidance systems on the FOBs, thus defeating it. So that system remained active on and off for probably close to a decade before it was finally shut down. And of course, there were a lot of issues with it. I mean, the response to this and stuff like that. But the idea was the defense wasn't a conventional ABM system, which was also being developed and in some respects deployed at that time using nuclear warheads. But the result was basically, you know what, we're going to have to use an anti-satellite weapon in order to defeat this fractional orbital bombardment. So the question is the U.S., does the U.S. have an operational ASAT capability that could potentially, you know, defeat or at least deter this type of capability from the Chinese? Or do we have the policy, do we have the impetus, do we have the ability to make a decision that says, you know what, we have to bite the bullet and we have to create a dedicated ASAT system in order to defeat this because we have no other, our conventional ABM systems just won't cut it.
This raises a question that I've been wrestling with for decades, really going back to my time in the Reagan administration, namely the necessity for the United States to have effective missile defenses. Anti-satellite systems are one thing, but if people will have the capability to launch perhaps thousands of warheads against us, the need for much more capability than a single or even a handful of anti-satellite technologies or capabilities, I think is something we have to address as a matter of national policy. And back in the Bush administration, the first Bush, George H.W. Bush administration, a colleague of mine, Ambassador Hank Cooper, was running the then called SDI program, Strategic Defense Initiative Program, and as you doubtless know, put together an actual workable plan for deploying in space what were then called Brilliant Pebbles, platforms that could be put up in large numbers and provide a space-based missile defense. It seems to me that the sensors and the missile interceptor technologies have obviously greatly improved since that time. But even then, the costs of that kind of capability were very manageable, and the kinds of defensive impediments to attacks, whether it's of a more conventional type that the Russians now or the Chinese could engage in, let alone something like this, the hypersonic variant, really demands that kind of space-based sensor and interceptor capability. What are your thoughts about that? And do you have any insights into how far away we might be from having such a capability today if we chose to deploy it?
Well, I think the technical end of it is one side altogether. And I'm not even going to go into that because, one, I'm not a technical person. I'm a legal and policy person. But the big problem really is the legal and the policy position on this. Now, the Russians and the Russian Federation and the People's Republic of China have been beating this idea of what we call, quote, space weapons to death for several decades. Now, the idea behind they introduced the treaty back in 2004 and then amended it back in, I believe it was 2014, called the PPWT. And you can look that up on a search engine. I'm not going to go through I don't remember the full, you know, full breaking out the full acronym there, but it's called the PPWT. But basically, the idea was supposed to be in, quote, space weapons. Now, weapons, and, you know, the Outer Space Treaty doesn't ban conventional weapons in outer space. It only bans the placement of nuclear weapons or nuclear devices in outer space. And that's really kind of a nuance that we don't have time to talk about here, but understand that. Placing nuclear weapons in orbit or fixating them or stationing them in outer space, bad. Conventional weapons are okay, though. So the idea of a Brilliant Pebbles or an SDI type of program are actually, you know, okay. In fact, I think the most controversial part of the Reagan plan was called the X-ray laser system, which actually involved the detonation of a nuclear weapon in space. Really, I think that would have been okay, too, under the Outer Space Treaty. And I can't go into detail here on this short period. But the idea is the Soviet Union and now the Russian Federation and the PRC have basically been beating this idea of space weapons to death in the UN. And it isn't about really, you know, peace in space. It's about missile defense right now because they know that, you know, placing space-based defense systems will definitely degrade their offensive forces, their ICBM forces. It could potentially affect this new, you know, hypersonic capability. But I think you'd have that defense system would have to be more of an ASAT nature in order to really deal with that. But that's, you know, that's technical, and we don't have time to get into that.
Well, so we'll get Ambassador Cooper on to discuss that technical side. But I think the point that you know so well, as one of the few people, Michael Listener, I've encountered who are practically minded, sensible, let alone robust on space as a very important domain for this country, both militarily and in terms of, you know, commercial activity, civilian experiments and so on. This business of the Russians and the Chinese endlessly harping on how space is pristine and must be kept that way, and there must be weapons bans there and so on, is, well, to put a fine point on it, a complete fraud. Because, as you know, they are hard at building military capabilities, including something I wanted, before we let you go, touch on at least briefly. The whole Chinese space program is a military program. It may have some dual use attributes, but it's fundamentally about military activity on the moon, in the cislunar space, the Lagrangian points, the low Earth orbit. It's all about dominating space as a military and strategic proposition, is it not?
Yes, I agree. And I try to get too hyperbolic when I say this, and, you know, I don't, you know, and go on to a rant, but in a sense, that's exactly what it is. It's about, you know, basically, it's about basically imposing their view of rule of law and order that from their perspective versus, say, what, you know, the U.S. and its allies would prefer to see. And really, the game, what they're doing in space, or what they're starting to do in space, is the same thing they've been doing in other domains. Like, well, the nine dash line in the South China Sea, perfect example of, you know, and I think really a dry run for what they may eventually try and do with space in orbit, possibly even, and more importantly, on the moon itself, establishing that idea of, you know, this is ours and to the exclusion of no other else, which is actually not what the Outer Space Treaty is about at all. And they acceded to that in 1983 and said, yeah, we agree with this, you know, free access idea. But in reality, my opinion is it's about kind of, you know, ensconing outer space into their own sphere of influence and basically for their exclusive use, and basically saying, you know, if you want to use it, you can use it ours. Again, I look at the nine dash line in the South China Sea as a prime example.
There you go. Exactly right. We have to leave it at that for the moment, Michael Listener, but this is a very important, very timely, and very much needed conversation, not just about the Chinese hypersonic missile capability, but what we're going to have to do about it. I hope that you'll be a frequent visitor here at Secure Freedom Radio now that we've found you, and the chance to pick your brains about both what the Chinese and Russians are up to and what we better be doing in space ourselves is something I look forward to with great expectation. Thank you for your time today, sir. Come back to us again soon, if you would. Next up, we'll speak with Sam Faddis about, well, the wrecking operation against our military and country, the hands of Joe Biden's administration. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and a pleasure to say, we're back with Sam Faddis. Charles Sam Faddis, of course, is a regular on this program, and I couldn't be more proud of that fact. He is a member of the Committee on the Present Danger China, which gives us an opportunity to collaborate on a lot of things, including a webinar today that we'll be talking about in a moment. Sam has an amazing background, former Army officer, former career clandestine services officer for the Central Intelligence Agency. That means a spy. He's gone on to a number of other impressive feats. He has been a candidate for Congress. He is an acclaimed author, including of Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the Central Intelligence Agency. He is also the driving force behind a simply superb online resource. It's called And Magazine. I encourage you to bookmark it, andmagazine.com. Sam Faddis will be a featured speaker in a program that, as we air tonight, is in the past. As we speak this morning, it is in the future. A webinar conducted by the Stop Vaccine Passports Task Force, an effort by the Committee on the Present Danger China and Women's Rights Without Frontiers to expose really important issues about the vaccines, the mandates, and most especially what is in prospect if we allow the government to gather and weaponize our personal information, starting with our health data. But it won't end there, alas. We'll be talking about specifically the catastrophe that Joe Biden's vaccine mandates are now constituting for the national security, and that is topic A with Sam Faddis. Welcome back, sir. It's so good to have you with us, as always.
Great to be here, Frank. Thank you very much.
So, Sam, as a former military officer, as a longtime government employee, what do you make of the mandates that Joe Biden is imposing and their implications for the national security in particular?
You know, I think it's just another arena where his policies are disastrous, right? I mean, first of all, there's just the sort of numbers thing, what the percentages of the military that we're talking about, which is hard to get a handle on. But we were talking, we are talking apparently about somewhere between 600 and 700 Navy SEALs who have not been vaccinated, just to kind of bring this down to a vignette, if you will. I mean, without going into exact numbers of SEALs on SEAL teams, I mean, if we're really talking about saying that we can't deploy 600 or 700 Navy SEALs, then effectively we don't have any SEAL teams anymore. I mean, that's what that means. That means name any mission you want to deploy these guys on. You don't have anybody left, certainly no unit that is actually capable and can be deployed. We've just wiped that entire capability off the map. I mean, the other thing that I think is going on here that's a little more emotional or ideological is that we have a massive problem in the military already with this sort of breach of faith as far as the rank and file are concerned by their senior leadership, loss of confidence in them, you know, between Afghanistan and wokeism and everything else. And now you've got a bunch of bureaucrats, basically, whether they're in uniform or not, ordering these guys and gals to be injected. I mean, that's just yet another reason for the folks who are actually supposed to do the fighting to feel completely disillusioned and really feel like, okay, look, why am I even doing this? Who am I doing it for?
And these are people, let us recall, who have volunteered to put their lives on the line for our country. They don't have to be doing this. And it is, most days, a thankless enough task without having all of this other collateral, demoralizing crap heaped upon them as well. We'll be talking more about the implications of this with Elaine Donnelly in a moment, in terms of the culture of the military. But Sam, just as you say, in terms of its practical impact, if these people, pilots, Marines, Navy SEALs, others with extraordinary specialization, skills, training, equipment, are not going to be ready to serve, available to do their duty if called upon, this is a huge problem, especially at a moment which, as you've been documenting magnificently at End Magazine, we may be at the cusp of a war with communist China. I mean, not just the ongoing Cold War, some call it unrestricted warfare, but a kinetic war. Talk a little bit about, you know, whether this is actually likely to translate into increasing the prospects of such a war.
So, well, yeah, without question. I mean, everything, of course, that the Biden administration has done since they came in my view, has increased the likelihood of a confrontation with the communist Chinese, because, good God, you're looking at an opportunity. When will you ever get an opportunity like this again? The most we can talk about whether this is just grotesque incompetence or deliberate malfeasance. I'm sort of a mind that it's the latter. But in any case, you're looking at an opportunity to run the table of the United States of America and change the entire balance of power to your advantage, what already is changing to your advantage, but to really seize this opportunity and do things that you've wanted to do for decades, like seized Taiwan, like literally follow through on the rhetoric that has not changed, since the nationalists went to Taiwan. Absolutely. And look, you know, to hone in on this practical impact, I mean, as you well know, it's bad enough that you're talking about demoralization. It's bad enough that you're talking about numbers of people you may not be able to deploy. But also, military units don't act as individuals. I mean, if you got 11 guys in a squad and you just announced that five of them can't be deployed, okay, and you reassign five guys to that squad. That does not make that squad combat effective. That makes five guys that puts five people that nobody's ever worked with in the middle of this unit. They're now working with a different unit. I mean, you can't just swap out pilots in fighter squadrons and really, when you're all done, say it's the equivalent. It's nowhere close to the equivalent. You're still combat ineffective, even if you brought the numbers up somehow magically. It's another thing that is a real threat, a strategic threat to American national security.
Sam, let me just pivot from the specific issue of the military, the armed forces, to other parts of our society and our economy that are also being impacted by Joe Biden's mandates, or those that are now being adopted by governments at lower levels or businesses, for that matter. We're watching police, firefighters, airline pilots, healthcare workers, and those involved in various aspects of our supply chains, to varying degrees, finding that they cannot serve either in this environment. Talk a little bit about what this means for, well, our economy, for one thing, but more to the point, our society and the kinds of conditions that we're likely to find ourselves in here in the days to come. Again, I'm of the view that this is a wrecking operation, that it's not an accident, and it is calculated to be extremely damaging. But give us your professional take on it, including, by the way, intelligence professionals, too, if you would.
Yeah, well, again, the scope of this, as you've laid out, I mean, this cuts across every sector of the society. And if we're just sort of focusing on security related things, it's devastating. Right. In Chicago, we now have a standoff between the police and the mayor, because the mandates that have come down now mean that something like 50% of the police force in Chicago faces termination. Seriously, if they follow through on the existing mandates, which they to date haven't backed off on, you're going to fire 50% of the cops on the street in a city, which
so if you
is
wanted
completely
to defund the police,
control,
or at least achieve the purpose of defunding the police, this certainly would be one way of accomplishing it, would it not?
I mean, this is effectively eliminating the police. In Seattle, they're talking 40%, close to half of the police force. So Seattle already has lost hundreds and hundreds of officers as a result of the war on police, defunding police, the whole Black Lives Matter business, just the hostility toward law enforcement. They're literally lost since the whole thing with the CHAZ, you know, the autonomous zone. They've lost something like 300 officers that have either retired or they just took a job someplace where somebody would actually support them. So they're already critically understaffed. Now you're going to take, say, 40% of that police force and you're going to get rid of them. They have gone in Seattle already to what they call, I think it's called phase three mobilization, which means that everybody who is a sworn officer, whoever was trained as law enforcement, is available to answer 911 calls. So that means the desk sergeant, the guy from the evidence locker, the people riding desks at any point in the force are now being dragooned into answering 911 calls. And when you read the language of what that means, like when you trigger a phase three mobilization, it explicitly says that we are facing a crisis that available public safety capabilities cannot handle. It is explicitly reserved for, you know, a complete meltdown, a crisis. I don't know, maybe there was a massive earthquake, something like this, and the city's completely out of control. They've already gone to that level of mobilization. This is in a major city, which, of course, is already facing all sorts of crime issues. I mean, you're talking here, and we could go on with any number of other major cities, literally just sort of going over the edge into anarchy. If you lose half the cops in Chicago, you better either barricade yourself in your house or you better get out of Chicago, because there's a nightmare coming.
And Sam, as you say, it's not just that criminals will take advantage of this situation. You and I have been talking about for well over a year the phenomenon of Antifa and Black Lives Matter and others involved in what I think is rightly described as a color revolution. They've been focused intensively, of course, as we know, on this idea that we ought to defund the police. What are the chances that enemy within will try to take advantage of this anarchic situation and the lack of public safety officers to contend with it?
Guaranteed. I mean, and just everybody listening, just think for a second of all of the images of what we watched month after month after month in major American cities when these forces like Black Lives Matter and Antifa and other groups were being confronted by fully staffed, fully manned police forces. Now imagine that that same level of violence is there and there's nobody to respond. I mean, in Minneapolis, they lost an entire precinct. The police officers had to literally run from the back of the building as the place was set fire to and the mob stormed in. Well, when half the cops in your city are gone, that's going to be every precinct. And who's coming, by the way, when the sun comes up in the morning, who's coming to restore order? Absolutely nobody is coming to restore order. There won't be any end to that.
Well, especially if the people that you might summon are National Guardsmen, or they're perhaps even active duty forces that have to be mobilized for the purpose, God forbid. And they're already afflicted with this same problem that we started out talking about. I mean, this is truly
absolutely
a wrecking operation. And I find it hard to countenance the idea that it is not intentional. I have to tell you, I don't believe you can attribute this and everything else. And we won't have time to get into much of the rest of it. The border, the energy security situation, the other effects of COVID on our society, the failure to contend with foreign threats emerging now all around us. We were talking in the earlier segment about this new hypersonic missile China is developing for sneak attacks. I mean, these are the sorts of things that are going to sap the morale and the confidence of the American people in their government, as well as, you know, the servicemen and women in their senior leadership and the police in their, you know, top management authorities. Leslie, let me just ask you this, Sam. If you were determined to fundamentally transform our country, yes, but specifically these institutions that are critical to its, you know, safety and its economy and its viability, really. One of the other things that you might see advantageous about driving out people who are patriots, people who are skilled warriors, people who are competent police officers, is that you can replace them with people who will do your bidding, perhaps even enforcing illegal or unconstitutional orders. Should we be concerned about that as an upshot of all of this as well?
Yeah, well, I think this is kind of the cutting edge of this whole thing, Frank. I mean, you know, as you look across the country and you see all of these crazy things that are happening, and I agree with you that I think we're dealing with malfeasance. I don't think we're dealing with incompetence. But you wonder increasingly where are the people who are to stand up for the Constitution? Where's the law enforcement person, the government person in DOJ, the government lawyer who just simply says, no, the answer is no, I won't do that. I won't enforce that order. I won't write that document. This is illegal. It's unconstitutional. It's destructive to the Republic, and I won't be part of it. And to the extent there are those people, we're now facing exactly what you laid out. They're sort of being boiled out of the system, right? They're resigning, they're quitting, they're going away. Okay, they're standing their ground in a sense, but we're also losing them. And who's left are the folks who either want to advance this agenda or at a minimum just won't stand up against it. They will, you know, they'll acquiesce. And that's ominous as well.
Also, by the way, folks, on Thursday, Sam Faddis is going to be a contributor to another webinar brought to you by the Committee on the Present Danger China about, well, it's an emergency summit on Taiwan, also required viewing. That will be from 10 to noon on Thursday Eastern Time. Stay tuned for that as well. And for Elaine Donnelly, who joins us next to talk about the impact on the culture of the military.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. And it is a delight to say we are joined by one of my favorite people in the whole world. Her name is Elaine Donnelly. She is a warrior of great courage, skill, and tenacity. And thank God for all of that. She runs an organization, founded it, and has been its driving force for, well, decades now, called the Center for Military Readiness. It's hard to overstate the importance of this organization or Elaine's work over the years. She has been one of those few people, not in uniform, never has worn the uniform, but who has served tirelessly as a voice for those who do wear the uniform and who often cannot be heard because of the nature of their service. In this field, she has been a both leader and an extraordinarily courageous spokesperson about a phenomenon most of us who have not been in military service really can't appreciate. We touched on it a little bit with Sam Faddis in the previous segment, but Elaine Donnelly understands and champions something unique and vital to our armed forces, something she calls the culture of the military. We want to talk to her about its condition today and threats that are emerging to it that really endanger our country and what we had best be doing about all of that. Elaine Donnelly, thank you so much for coming back. It's great to visit with you. It's been too long, but it's timely
to
do it now.
Thank you for that very kind introduction. These are difficult times for our military right now. People are under pressure, not just because of these mandates that really make no sense. People are being forced out, being told that they are not acceptable in the armed forces according to woke standards. And every year there's legislation that is offered called the National Defense Authorization Act. Every year it gets passed. My organization has not opposed this bill in the past. But this year, we are opposing this defense bill. It deserves defeat because not only would it change selective service law to include women for the first time in our history, it would change the actual purpose of selective service to an open-ended opportunity for the government bureaucrats to commandeer the lives of young people for 2 years for reasons other than national defense. There's also in these bills, there are two versions right now, the House and Senate. The House bill in particular has mandates that would turn woke policies, CRT instructions, anti-extremism programs that are very divisive, very loaded against people who are not minorities, and diversity mandates and quotas, all of that would be codified by passage of this bill. So even though there's been a lot of discussion and opposition from Senator Cotton and others who are opposed to critical race theory being taught at the military service academies and in the military in general, here comes this bill where Congress would put its stamp of approval with its votes to make it permanent. This is unacceptable. And anybody who cares about these issues needs to get busy. Tell the senators, you will not accept this. Organizations that score votes should score in the negative. Anyone who votes for the defense bill this year. Now, I know that's difficult to do. It hasn't happened before. But this bill is so unacceptable. It cannot be allowed to be signed into law. Even a new president would not be able to undo the damage. So that's where we are right now.
I want to drill down on all of that in more detail. But before we do, just humor me, because I want to both call attention to the work you've done to date and how that is really underpinning the comments you've just made. You have for years been warning about the damage that's being done to the culture of the military through things like social engineering that notably was done during, I guess, the Clinton administration, to some extent, big time into the Obama years, and is very much present at the moment under the Obama team. But before we get to any of that, just talk a little bit about this culture of the military. What is that? Why is it so important to the performance of the military, the ability to do the job we need it to do for our survival?
Well, thank you. The culture of the military starts with priority. If you say that things like equal opportunity or social agendas are more important, you're going to weaken the military. If you say that non-discrimination and meritocracy are the highest priorities, you're going to have a stronger military. What we've seen in recent years especially is an inversion of priorities to the extent that social agendas are being driven. It started with women in combat and the idea that men and women are interchangeable in all roles, including the infantry. Well, the data, if we talk about science and the data, not only does not support that, it refutes the idea that men and women are interchangeable in combat units such as the infantry and special operations forces and the like. And yet, here we have policymakers under the current administration and all those who came over from the Obama administration. They are denying reality. They're trying to impose this agenda on the armed forces in life and death situations, where if people cannot support each other with equal strength and endurance and commitment to the mission, because you have some people who are not as strong, don't have as much endurance, and even though they're just as courageous, they just don't have the wherewithal and the physical abilities to be interchangeable with men. What you're doing is endangering lives of both men and women, and you're weakening the armed forces. Our potential adversaries, China and North Korea, must be just loving this. Here we have China with missiles around the world, this hypersonic missile. They are concentrating on priorities different than the culture of our military today, which is concentrating on what? Woke policies, critical race theory, anti-extremism, drafting our daughters. All these kinds of social agendas are counterproductive, and they're dangerous in a dangerous world. So, yes, we've been following these issues for years. It's very disappointing to see things play out as they are, but our military is resilient. Yes, but the military is resilient. A new president hopefully would be able to turn much of this around, as Donald Trump did during his administration. But my concern is if Congress codifies wokeism in the military, that is going to be nearly impossible to do. And that's why that's why there's so much urgency right now.
Right. And if confidence in the leadership of the military, especially on the part of those in the more junior ranks, is shot, that will be a difficult thing to undo very quickly as well. But let's just come back to this defense authorization bill. I worked many, many years ago, Elaine, as you may remember, on the Senate Armed Services Committee. Its principal job each year was crafting this piece of legislation, the defense authorization bill, as they call it, not to be confused with the defense appropriations bill. One sets the policies and the pay rates and, you know, gives guidance to the military. The other essentially gives them the wherewithal to fund the programs and do their various missions. The defense authorization bill over the years has become, well, must-pass legislation, a fairly unique thing in the Congress these days. And that means that it often gets larded up with stuff that doesn't belong there and sometimes makes the bill controversial. But what you're describing, Elaine, in terms of policies that are being formally approved by the Congress under the Democrats in the House, now both the House Armed Services Committee, the Senate Committee's counterpart, and the full House itself has bought into this. And when you say woke, Elaine, I just want to be clear with people. This is a communist agenda. We can dress it up as progressive or all kinds of other things, but it is all about implementing policies and divisive, you know, directions that are calculated to devastate institutions, notably, in this case, the military. But
yeah,
beyond that, Elaine, you're looking at the Senate Armed Services Committee has now approved, again, under Democratic control, something very similar. So it goes to the Senate floor, is that right?
No, don't let the Republicans off the hook. This vote had the support of so-called conservative Republicans, including Senator Marsha Blackburn, Tom Tillis, Rick Scott. And this is in committee, the Senate Armed Services Committee. The vote was lopsided in favor of this bill. Now, they should have known better. The vote took place behind closed doors, and we didn't even get the text of that bill until recently. This was back in July. Now, let me read you two passages from the House bill that demonstrate what I'm talking about here. They're short. Instead of proposing legislation to limit the woke policies in the military, the House bill would establish an Office of Combating Extremism, which would, and this is a quote, engage and interact with and solicit recommendations from outside experts on extremism. Now, who are those experts? Well, Southern Poverty Law Center, people who assume that anybody who voted for Donald Trump is an extremist. There's the bureaucracy being established by Congress if this House language should pass. The House bill also calls for expansion and codification of Defense Department diversity, equity, and inclusion training programs to include, and this is a quote, conscious and unconscious bias instructions, unquote, that are typical of critical race theory programs. Whether intended or not, a vote for this defense bill is a vote to expand and codify unacceptable woke policies in the military. So this bill is not just a funding bill, not this year. It would turn the military officially into an organization that promotes the left's favorite woke initiatives. That's why this bill, unlike any other, has got to be defeated. These objectionable parts have to be taken out, and the senators have to be held accountable for voting for this, the House members as well.
I couldn't agree with you
more. But it may come
down
to the conference committee. I don't know.
Well, Elaine, let me just make sure I'm clear about where things stand at the moment. And again, this is why the work of the Center for Military Readiness is so vital. And it's not being done. I mean, there are larger institutions, think tanks and policy centers and so on. I'm very proud of our Center for Security Policy, but we need to get on this in support of what you're doing, Elaine, I believe, and I hope we will in the days to come. But here's the thing. This kind of legislative activity done behind closed doors, often because there's classified programs and stuff that need to be handled. But I've never heard of the Senate not having the texts of the bill and the report language, which is always very detailed, long before the Senate is asked to take it up. And am I right in understanding that the Senate, Senate
and
has not yet considered this legislation, but will soon?
Senate will vote on it soon, and then there'll be a conference committee. But in the Senate Armed Services Committee, even the vote, the names of the people who voted in favor of it, was not released for a while. It took a detective to find out who voted. Now, there's more. Let me tell you what else is going on here. Joe Biden and the Department of Defense has called for a climate adaptation plan, declaring climate change is an existential threat to our nation's security. That's a quote. Okay. Now, at the same time, have you been watching this $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill? It calls for $8 billion for something called the Civilian Climate Corps, CCC. That would be part of the Green New Deal. Now, if selective service is changed to include diverse mobilization needs that are, quote, not solely to provide combat replacements, okay, that's in the House bill. What you have here is an open-ended vehicle where young people could be brought into this. They would be called, quote, volunteers, unquote, for make work Department of Defense priorities, which could include addressing the climate, so-called climate crisis. Now, all of this was presaged by a major national commission set up by John McCain, the late John McCain, back in 2016, called the National Commission on Military, National, and Public Service. They spent $45 million over 3 years. They've recommended all of this. In fact, language in this defense bill came right out of that commission's report. So it's all there if you want to look for where this progress is going. It's going into the area of mandatory conscription, of both men and women, purposes other than combat. They're trying to, you know, put everybody at ease. Oh, don't worry, women won't be in combat. No, if there is a need for combat soldiers, women will be inducted on the same basis as men, minimally qualified women. Draft our daughters is part of this deal. It's the starting point of an even larger program that is even worse than the Draft Our Daughters bill that was so controversial back in 2016. Now, the American people are not paying attention to this. Most people think, oh, we haven't had selective service in many years. It's not going to happen. Never will. Well, excuse me, the infrastructure is being laid down here for not just Draft Our Daughters, but to involve young people in working and government-directed projects. Okay, that means politically correct. That means woke. That doesn't mean volunteer activities at your local church, your pro-life center. No way. This would be directed by government bureaucracy, and it would be a system of carrots and sticks. Okay, if you do certain things, you'll get benefits. If you don't, you will get penalties. It sort of smacks of the Chinese social credit system, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Yes. So when you look at the full scope of what is going on here, the Congress hasn't even begun to debate this issue. They haven't even begun to look at what Draft Our Daughters is about, the data, the research done by the Marine Corps. My organization put testimony under their noses and said, look at what the Marine Corps found. You can't interchange men and women in the combat arms. I doubt that they even looked at it. They just rubber stamped what was put before them, and here we are.
Elaine Donnelly, this is so alarming. And yet it's one of those places, folks, where you can actually make a difference. The United States Senate is supposed to be the world's greatest deliberative body. It's fallen short of that standard for years now. I remember very fondly working for some great United States senators like Senator Henry Scoop Jackson and Senator John Tower. I can assure you, folks, that had there been people like them in the Senate Armed Services Committee, as they were when I was working for it, none of this would have transpired, let alone be as close to becoming law as it is at the moment. We have to stand against this. And Elaine, your leadership, and I want to urge everyone to go to cmrlink.org and view as an urgent order of business the lead story there, why the defense bill deserves defeat. It is vital that everyone in this audience understands what is afoot here and what can be done now before the Senate acts and perhaps in the conference committee to change what could be really the undoing of the Defense Department, in addition to what we've been talking about previously in the personnel space, in terms of the policies. So, Elaine, thank you for this incredibly important conversation. Very timely for the work that you do at cmrlink.org. You can donate to Elaine's program. I hope you will help her keep this vital, authoritative vehicle for making known to the rest of us what is being done to the culture of the military and to the military itself as a vital institution. And we hope we can help you keep it as strong and as patriotic as it needs to be, Elaine. Thank you for your time today. Come back to
thank
us again
you,
soon, if you will. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station.
You've been
Until
listening
then,
to Secure Freedom
Frank
Radio with
Thanks
Frank Gaffney.
For